With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at Marines.com.
Hello and welcome to the 66 to 87 podcast here on DK Pittsburgh Sports Radio. I am your host, Tom Reed, and we are joined today by our fine Penguin writers, Taylor Haas and Dave Molinari, who have both been driving back from the road from separate places on the East Coast. Taylor coming in from the D.C. Baltimore area, and Dave from his second home in Long Island, where I'm sure he has a place in the Hamptons by now. He's been there so long. Split weekend for the Penguins, rallying ferociously to win in overtime on Saturday night, and then dropping a 2-0 decision Sunday, where they just looked lifeless. But what will not be lifeless is PPG Paints Arena on Tuesday, where for the first time, the Penguins are set to welcome back fans. I believe up to maybe up to 2,800 maybe, but 15% capacity indoors. That ruling came down on Monday from the state government, and the city was more than happy to get things going. I want to get your guys' thoughts on this. Great timing for a team that's going to host 12 of its next 16 games. Taylor?
Yeah, I mean, that's huge. And I just think of what this maybe could do for Evgeny Malkin's game, because we've mentioned before on here that, you know, that's something that might be affecting him, not having that energy to play off of. When he spoke a couple weeks ago, he brought that up like unprompted. He wasn't asked about the fans, but he said, you know, it's hard playing without the fans. So I'm just thinking, you know, what could this do for Evgeny Malkin's game, getting those home fans back for this long stretch?
Dave, this team has, even when there was nobody in the building, had we talked about this a few weeks ago, they've been pretty good at home. I think 7-1. What boost can they receive from getting folks back in the building?
Well, it'll be interesting to see exactly what the crowd's like. I know the Rangers last week had fans in the building for the first time. I believe they had around 2,000. And one of the players was quoted as saying it sounded like 20,000. So you have to figure there's some pent-up energy and enthusiasm among the fans. But I think it's entirely possible that both teams, home and away, not necessarily just in Pittsburgh, will benefit from having fans in the buildings, you know, at least for a few weeks, just because it will be such a change. You know, it's been essentially a year since any of these guys played before a significant audience. I think that, even if you're getting booed, you know, as the Flyers probably can expect to be, over the next three games at PPG Paints Arena, that, you know, it might give you a little bit of adrenaline, give you a little extra hop.
Yeah, I it's very interesting. I think I was looking it up. March 8th is the last time the Penguins played a home game where there were fans in the building. I think they lost to Carolina that night. And of course, nobody could have at that point thought that it would be this long. I think maybe at the time, in talking with people in recent weeks, they knew something might be coming. When the NHL went out, they talked about having a pause. But I don't think a lot of people thought we'd be a year later on March 2nd and just finally getting fans back in the buildings. For you two, I want to ask you guys have, and one of the great things about DK Pittsburgh Sports, we're everywhere. We are not watching these games from TV. Our writers have been out. You two and DK have been, at least one of you guys have been at the games. give our listeners a sense of what it's like in a building with no fans. Taylor?
Yeah. So at PPG, it's, they've done a pretty good job at pumping in like fake crowd noise. Like after a while, I think it was jarring at first, not having like the actual fans there, but they've done a pretty okay job at, you know, pumping in the crowd noise, and, you know, they mix in like chants and, you know, turning up when they cheer. So in at PPG, you don't really hear a whole lot of what happens on the ice. But I mean, in other buildings, like I was just in DC, talked about on the last episode, they have us pretty close and they're not pumping in anything. And you can hear every word they say on the ice, which is cool. I mean, for us, probably not ideal for the players, because, you know, if they're talking to each other, the other team can hear it a lot more clearly than they would otherwise. I don't know. That's I think that's one of the things I'm going to miss, though, once things do go back to normal, is being able to hear all the conversations or Tom Wilson running his mouth like he was in D.C. from the penalty box.
Dave, I went to a couple of the Steelers games late in the season when the fans were no longer allowed in the building, and it felt like an exhibition game. And one of the games were a playoff game. There was nothing. I just your experience. You know, you've obviously been covering this team for a long time, and this is certainly a first for you. What has this been like for you?
I mean, you know, the whole experience for the last year has been pretty bizarre. You know, the way everything about where we sit at games, you know, how we conduct interviews, you know, there's nothing normal about the way business has been conducted lately. And, you know, going to games where there are no fans is just another aspect of the weirdness. And, you know, the crowd noise probably, you know, helps the players somewhat, because I don't know how much time they spend actually looking at fans. And if they just have that, you know, noise in the background, there's, you know, probably gives a sense of normalcy to what's going on. Although I have to say that at Nassau Coliseum, having covered four games there in February, they crank up the canned noise awfully loud there, like to an unnatural level, to the point where it's actually kind of a distraction. I can't tell you whether the players felt that way or not, but it was pretty clearly not at a normal, you know, crowd buzz level.
Yeah, it's and Taylor, I think you're right. I mean, with Malkin, what he said, and we've mentioned this before, I think different athletes do respond to the outside stimulus or stimuli different. I think that there's teams that have not played as well at home. I'm a huge soccer fan, a Liverpool fan. They were unbeatable for like 3 years at home. They've lost four in a row at home. There are teams that just seem to feed off emotion in buildings. And I think it's going to be really interesting. Dave, you alluded to this a couple of seconds ago. The Rangers, first game back, they beat the Bruins like 6-2. You could just tell that they were pumped up to finally play in front of people. I think it'll be an interesting scene tonight at home. And you know those fans, whoever gets in, season ticket holders get the first dibs. They've got to be loving this to finally get a chance to get back and cheer their team.
Yeah, well, they've had just a couple of fans, like healthcare workers in the suites since the beginning. Right. And even like those fans, like, you know, like when there's a goal, it seems like they're making up for the lack of energy from the, you know, having everyone there. I mean, yeah, you just see it from them. So yeah, it'll be interesting. I'm just worried about losing my parking spot. I've been parking right in front of the media entrance on that, like on the street right by the building. Yeah, if they're letting in 2,800 people, I might lose that spot.
I did a story last week with fans and asked them what it's been like and just, you know, again, not being able to go to games. But the people, I guess the point I want to make here is fans that will now get to go into games. It's going to be different. You're going to be excited. You're going to get a chance to watch your team play again. But a lot of times these people won't be in their same seats. The people that they've had gone to games with for a long time that are sitting in their sections won't be around. There'll be people four or five rows up. It'll be very – and the ushers will be watching to make sure people are trying to socially distance and you know, have their faces covered. So I'll be very interested to see how the fans – the fan experience actually is. Now, of course, if the Penguins are winning, that's gonna do for a lot of it. But are you interested, Dave, to see just the reaction to the fans? We spoke about the players are going to be happy about it, but how the fans get into this?
Yeah, I mean, I think that they will probably be very much into it just because, you know, there will be a year's pent-up enthusiasm and energy. And, you know, that going to a hockey game, I think for a lot of people, will be a significant step back toward life as we knew it a year ago. So I think people will be, you know, pretty fired up. It will be interesting to hear if there are any sort of chants, what they sound like when everybody is chanting through a mask. You'd think that will muffle things a bit, but, you know, so, okay, it'll probably still be a little bit different, but it will be a nice change, you know, on many levels.
And Taylor, we mentioned at the very beginning, this comes at a great time in a very tight race in the East to have 12 of your next 16 at home.
Yeah, that'll be huge. I mean, they have been good at home. There still kind of has been that home ice advantage. Marino talked about it a couple weeks ago that, you know, even without that fans, they do still kind of have that home ice advantage just because you're more comfortable at home. You go through your normal routine. So, I mean, that'll be big. Plus, what, they're going to start actually playing Buffalo and New Jersey, which should be helpful, too, for their getting points in the standings.
Oh, Buffalo's a disaster. I'm not sleeping on the – I would not sleep on the Devils. The Devils, to me, they've been – I don't think we ever really discussed this fully, but I think they're an improved team than in years past. And don't forget, you know, we're at the 20-game mark. Taylor, you and I have discussed this. Dave has kind of been – he's kind of held the fence. It's kind of played out how we thought. The four or five teams that we thought were going to be competing for the four spots are the ones there. I think the one wild card team is New Jersey. And, again, they missed some time with COVID. So you got to know that they could make a push too. We'll see. Stay with us. We'll be back for our second segment of the 66 to 87 podcast. Welcome back to the 66 to 87 podcast. We'll be joined a little bit later by TSN insider Frank Cervalli to talk about the Penguins and talk about some league issues. But guys, let's talk a little bit right now about the game yesterday, Sunday, the 2-0 loss. And Taylor, that was a game. Well, they've certainly had some problems throughout the season. That was the first time I saw them from start to finish where they just didn't seem to have anything. And they've got four back-to-backs coming up in March. The schedule's going to get – the games are going to start coming thick and fast. And you think that was just a one-off, or is that something you worry about as they start to go forward here?
It's hard to say. I mean, because that was their first back-to-back of the season. It was not the Islanders' first back-to-back series of the season. I think that was their third, maybe their fourth. So I don't know if that plays a factor, but I mean, they've all played back-to-backs before. I don't know if like this season is that much of a difference. But I mean, yeah, that was definitely, concerning. Cause I mean, what, the only guy who had it that game was Casey DeSmith. That was, from really like top to bottom, not good.
Dave, jump in there.
Well, I think the obvious explanation here is that all of his teammates really dislike Casey DeSmith because based on the way they played, they really wanted to make his life as difficult as possible on Sunday. He really is the only thing that kept the Islanders' margin of victory from becoming embarrassingly high for the Penguins. He was very, very good. And I thought that they got a pretty good effort out of Crosby, but there weren't a whole lot of guys who were interested in following that example. And it led to, you know, pretty interesting reaction from Mike Sullivan after the game, where he was giving some very terse responses to the questions that he was getting from reporters. He obviously was not in a mood to get into a lengthy discussion of what he had just witnessed.
That's as Taylor. That's as angry as I've seen him this year. And terse is a good word. I would like to transcribe that one. Sometimes you don't like to transcribe post game stuff. That would have taken like 3 minutes. Have you seen him as angry as he was and justified for that anger yesterday?
I mean, definitely not this season. I mean, he had a couple of answers that were only one word or very short. I mean, he was asked, you know, like what would the score have been if you know, Casey DeSmith wasn't as good as he was, and it was like a really awkward, like long pause, and then he just said Casey was good, and then that was like the end of the press conference. But I mean, he did have a couple of short answers. I mean, but he was justified. Didn't get the effort he wanted from the team. Like we said, pretty bad from almost top to bottom. Yeah, not surprised to see that kind of reaction from him post game.
Dave, in the course of every season, and maybe because this is such a short season, this stuff gets magnified a game like yesterday. But, man, in the course of every season, a team has – if you're playing an 82-game schedule or an 80-game schedule, teams have three or four of these games, don't they, at least during the course of a season?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, everybody has a bad day at the office, you know, no matter what line of work you're in, whether, you know, you're – shoe salesman or an accountant or a left winger. You know, not everybody is on every day. And yeah, if you only have three or four games like that over the course of 82, that really isn't bad. But that doesn't make it any easier for the department head, or in this case, the head coach, to accept when you get a subpar performance from the employees. And that certainly was subpar on Sunday in just about every regard.
Yeah. One regard in which it was subpar, and unfortunately for Mike Sullivan and the fans, that it's been subpar for a long time this season, has been the special teams. And let's break down both units. We've talked on the show about the power play, but let's get into this penalty kill. I mean, goals in 15 of the 20 games. I think, Dave, you had a stat in your story. What was it? 11 of the last 14 that they've surrendered power play goals. What is going on with that PK? Is it one explanation? Are there multiple things? Have the circumstances and the reasons for it changed, Taylor, as the season's gone on?
It's really tough to say because they just played, you know, the series against the Capitals. And what it was that first game. I mean, the Capitals went into that series with the number one power play in the league. The Penguins PK has been hovering around, you know, the bottom of the league pretty much the whole season. And that first game against the Capitals, the Caps had two power play opportunities, both in the first period, and they didn't get a single shot off on either opportunity. And I did the drive to the net, like breaking it down. And the reason they didn't get any shots off is because they never got a chance to set up. Like at all. Sullivan, he attributed it to like cooperative pressure, you know, the neutral zone. The Capitals never had a chance, you know. Ovechkin, very dangerous from the left circle. You don't have to worry about a shot there if you don't let him get there in the first place. So, I mean, that was really impressive to see. And then they just go and, you know, back to what they were doing before, and, you know, how they were bad again against the Islanders, two power play goals, they allowed. But, I mean, it's hard to say. Sullivan was asked, you know, after, you know, which is the real, you know, PK, you know, and he said, we are what we are. So I don't know what that means either. But yeah, it's hard to say what the issue is when they can be so good, like they were against the Caps, and then go right back to, you know, how they played against the Islanders.
Dave, I wonder part of it, you know, I'm you guys have been watching these guys for years. I watch them a lot more now. I love Bluger and Tanev together. I think they're a really good pairing. But I wonder, you know, early in the season, what did we talk about? We talked about the goaltending struggling below the bar. What else have we talked about a lot is the defenseman, the injuries to defensemen, guys playing different partners and maybe, you know, different penalty kill partners, a new system, you know, new coaching, a new coach running it. Is it, do you think it's just a multiple things and maybe it starts to shake out as the some of the defensemen come back, or is, you know, how do you see this getting remedied?
Well, I'm not sure that we have to break down the penalty killing because it's done a pretty good job of breaking down on its own. But no, I think all of those things that you mentioned probably were factors and legitimate ones early in the season, but really none of them, you know, should be reflected in the penalty kill at this point. You know, they've had 20 games of operating in Mike Vellucci's penalty killing system. The defensemen are getting pretty healthy. I mean, you're always going to have some injuries to deal with. And you know, they have personnel that, you know, really should be much better than it has been, you know, in terms of the unit to this point of the season. Special teams going into the season, I think a lot of us believed that they would be a real strength for this team. But not only the penalty kill, but the power play has just terribly underachieved through the first 20 games. And, you know, if that doesn't change, it's really hard to picture this team sneaking into a playoff spot.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. Taylor, I'll let you jump in here a second. To me, especially a PK, if you can't kill penalties late in the season and you are in a race, and clearly this, I mean, the Pens are a little bit on the outside looking in right now, but that's such a tight race, those first five or six teams. But just a bad PK could be the deciding thing, that if you get in or get out. So, Taylor, jump in on that.
Yeah, well, to the earlier point, I mean, Teddy Bluger did say, it was like maybe 2-3 weeks ago by now, that part of it is that, you know, new, you know, assistant coach running the PK, new system, and, you know, so much of the PK has to be intuitive, and that's hard to do when you're in the process of learning a new system. You know, they can't really read off of each other until they have the system down. But I mean, by this point, I don't know if you can use that as like an excuse, because I mean, we are what, 2 months into the season now. So I don't know how much of it is still on learning a new system.
Yeah. And in fairness on Sunday, I mean, just the first goal was just as Dave wrote, if Casey DeSmith had got over there, there may have been a hole in him. That puck was shot so hard. And the second one, Rust gets there, deflects it, and it becomes an off-speed pitch, which kind of goes between the wickets, I think, of Casey DeSmith. You know, he might have been better off not even touching the puck. Smith might have had a better chance to save it. So I'm sure there's a level of frustration. I know there's got to be a level of frustration with this power play. I mean, it is. We talk about this power play so much, and it just continues, and it continues to struggle. It continues to let them down in games. What more can we, Dave, jump in there on this and tell me, give fans a reason to think that things are going to get better with this unit.
Do I really have to?
We're trying. Trying to build up listeners, Dave.
Considering you know how long, you know, this power play has been guilty of overpassing. I mean, that's not something that just developed this year. I mean, it's been a chronic issue with this power play where they simply don't shoot enough. It gets redundant, but there's really no great secret to succeeding on a power play. You get pucks and bodies to the net. It's not complicated, and they tend to just move the puck around the perimeter and maybe look for a nice backdoor pass or something like that. But when they have success on the power play, it's when they shoot. And you'd think it would be in their own interest of self-preservation to score on the power play, apparently, or occasionally, because if you don't, opponents are going to have no reservations about taking physical liberties with you. The Penguins don't have an enforcer type who's going to physically intimidate opponents, put the fear of God into them if they go after a Crosby or a Gensel or something like that. And so if you're not going to deter that kind of thing by hurting the opponent with a power play goal, what incentive do they have to not pummel you at every opportunity?
Taylor Letang did get one here recently. I think that it was, just a point shot, right? Just fire the puck from the point. What is so hard to get through to those guys that occasionally it's okay to go low to high and shoot the puck and get a little bit of traffic. A lot of teams do that.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, these kind of WebEx calls that we do kind of feels like Groundhog Day by now, that, what's not clicking with the power play? And they all say, you have that many skilled guys that they are looking for the pretty play. So it's not anything that they're not aware of. So they don't need to be told that they're not shooting enough. But I mean, like we said, this has been an issue for a while now. So I don't know what the answer is. Put the PK guys out there on the power play. Cause how many shorthanded goals do they have?
They've got a couple, I think.
Yeah, right? I mean, but Tanev just got one in Washington.
Yeah.
Just if they're going to shoot, put the guys that'll shoot out there.
Well, yeah, I mean, on some levels, it sounds crazy to sit some of the guys who are on the first power play because of the exceptional skill levels they have. But skill levels don't automatically translate to goals. And if it doesn't matter how talented you are, if you're not going to shoot the puck, that talent doesn't do you any good. I would, if I were overseeing this power play, I would certainly consider, shaking up that, especially that top unit. I think the second unit tends to play, more in the style that you expect of a power play. But, I would consider putting maybe a Kapanen on the first unit. Whatever failings he has, and Mike Sullivan seems to zero in on all of them, he certainly is willing to shoot the puck. And I think that would be a welcome change and a pretty good remedy for the primary issue that ails this power play.
Well, and people talk about the lack of like a net front presence too, but I mean, a point Sullivan made like two, 3 weeks ago by now is that, if they're not shooting the puck, why would anyone go to the front of the net and make that choice to get, kidney punched when you're not going to get a redirect or, a rebound goal because no one's putting the puck there. He said, if we start shooting the puck more, maybe guys will be more inclined to go to the front of the net and get beat up like that. But I mean, and you do see that on the second unit. I don't know. Wilkes-Barre's power play is great. Like, just bring them up. Put Josh Curry on the top unit in Pittsburgh. It can't hurt.
Well, usually with most power plays, especially one with as talent laden as the first unit, they usually play a minute and 30 seconds. And that second unit gets on for scraps at the end. So it's that it's hard. You'd almost have to, as Dave maybe mentioned, is just in, you know, if you want to shake something up, start the second unit once or twice in here and see what happens. Last thing in this segment, Evgeny Malkin talked after the game, Dave, yesterday. I think he thought he's going to get it going here. He feels it might be coming at some point. What did he have to say? And do you take anything from it? Are you seeing anything that he's really going to pick up his game? Because he's had a couple of goals here and there, but he did not sound real enthused yesterday when he spoke.
Well, I would have been concerned if any of them had sounded enthused after the performance that they, again, with the exception of Casey DeSmith, turned in that day. I think Malkin has been better, you know, in the past handful of games. But, you know, the bar he's cleared by doing that was set awfully low by his play before that. He can get better, and he has to get better. They simply can't afford to have him, you know, make just the occasional contribution if they're going to have any sort of successful season. He's just too important.
Taylor, I think these tie in with these two topics tie in to get with each other. We're just talking about the power play. He's obviously a big part of that first unit, and it's failings. What have you seen of his game on the power play?
Yeah, it's the same stuff that's ailing the rest of the unit: overpassing, not shooting when they have the puck. But I mean, just in general with Malkin, I don't know if it's the effort. Some games it seems like you're just coasting around, but then you'll he'll turn it on. You know, a couple of recent overtime games, he's had really good. He just looked really good. You know, when it matters. But I don't know. Like we talked about in the first segment, I don't know if the crowd could help him, and if it's you know, he needs that energy to shoot the puck. But I guess we'll see.
I mean, you guys, I mean, I kind of parachute in over the years, and I just, when he is in that right circle, to me, if I'm an opponent, it throws the fear of God into me, because he can whip that puck from the right side. And I've seen him score so many goals, and it's all what we're talking about. Why don't you try that? Just set him up and let him crank it. Have people ask him why he specifically is not shooting from over there where he's so good at it?
I honestly not that I know of. You know, it's not like we have access to speak with him on any sort of regular basis. But he, you know, doesn't seem to be more inclined to get the puck toward the net than anybody else on that number one unit. So I don't know. I wish I had an answer for this, because as I think I've mentioned previously, I'd love to be able to sell it to the Penguins for big money, because a productive power play versus a non-productive one could be the difference between playoff revenue and not playoff revenue for this team.
Yeah, and you're absolutely 100%, because if they don't get this, and again, I think it's as critical as anything is getting the penalty killing straightened out. They may be on the outside looking in, but when we come back on our final segment of the 66-87 podcast, we will be joined by TSN insider Frank Cervalli. Stay with us. To the 66-87 podcast on DK Sports Radio. And it is our pleasure now to be joined by TSN insider Frank Cervalli. Frank, thanks for taking some time today.
Yeah, glad to connect with you guys.
Great. Frank, obviously the Penguins have made some news here. They've been certainly in the news this season with Jim Rutherford stepping down, Ron Hextall and Brian Burke joining the management team, and the team actually playing a little bit better as of recently. What have your impressions of this team been through 20 games?
You know, just starting with opening night and seeing them kind of before the season started, my expectations were that this would be a team. I saw them as a firm playoff team. And in fact, I had thought that the changes that Jim had made over the summer or the offseason had positioned this team perhaps to have the best defense core that they had in a number of years. And there's been some shakiness to it. There's obviously been some injuries as well. And the goaltending hasn't held up its end of the bargain, which has made life really difficult on everyone. We all know how much a talented goalie and one that's playing well really covers up a team's flaws. But I think they're getting to the point now where they've found themselves a bit and they're sort of right in that mix. Like I saw them in the 3-4 spot in terms of the East. And they're going to have to scratch and claw to get in there. But I think they're right in that mix.
Yeah.
Frank, the Flyers are a team that is obviously on the rise. You see them on a pretty regular basis living in Philadelphia. What's allowed them to have the success that they've had so far this year? And is there anything about that team that people who just follow them on a casual basis might not be aware of?
Not sure that there's anything that's there's no like secret ingredient or special sauce with that team. They compete. They compete like bastards. And so that's part of it. And the other part is they're just deep. They've got, you know, this wave after wave attack that kind of comes at you. And I think that's allowed them to be really successful. And I think the other part is they've gotten some contributions that may be a little bit of a surprise, like James Van Riemsdyk being well north of a point per game player and scoring 10 goals to this point. I don't think anyone saw that coming. But Joel Farabee is a guy that's taken a big step for them. He's been near a point per game player. And they've got, you know, really 3 to 4 strong lines that there's not a huge drop off. So it's allowed their other kind of, if you want to call them aging stars, Giroux at 33 and Voracek at 31 to take a back seat in a way. And I think that's really, you know, helped them out that they're not really being relied on to do the heavy lifting.
You were in Philly for the you're on the Flyers beat for the beginning of Hextall's tenure there. Just what were your impressions of what he did for the Flyers, his strengths, and what maybe his mistakes were as Flyers GM?
Well, I don't think anyone ever really questioned Ron Hextall's ability to run a hockey team and draft well and develop well. And so I think there was always a lot of confusion as to his exit. It was reported that he didn't see eye to eye in terms of philosophy, that there was a philosophical difference between Ron Hextall and Flyers upper management. And I don't know that that was necessarily the case either. I think really it was the question mark was always in Ron Hextall's ability to manage up one and two to handle the off-ice part of it. And I don't know that he ever managed people well in his position. And so I think that really ended up being his undoing in Philadelphia. And now that he's in Pittsburgh and has the opportunity to focus more on the hockey part of it, and you have Brian Burke coming in with him to manage sort of the rest of it, and be at times the public facing part of it, in addition to being the public facing part of it, but also that buffer between hockey ops management and then ownership and David Morehouse, that I think it's going to work out really well. Now, I think the big question mark that everyone's really not concerned, but is intrigued to see is how Ron Hextall and Brian Burke grow to work with each other. These are two really strong personalities. two people that, you know, have beliefs and, you know, can be, I don't know if abrasive is the right word, but headstrong. They're confident people. And, you know, those two guys sometimes are like pit bulls on a meat wagon. It's hard to shake them off. And so I think that's really where I'm interested and intrigued to see. And I think Ron Hextall has had a lot of time to sit and digest where things went off the rails in Philly. And I think you'll see him handle a number of things differently than he might have now that he's gotten a second crack.
Yeah. What do you think, I mean, Burke's influence will be? I mean, because he is very old school. Do you think, you know, he's changed his views or his ways since he was a general manager before?
I don't know. It's hard to say. And I always I struggle at times putting people in boxes in terms of this guy's old school, this guy's new school. I think, you know, Brian Burke's been around a long time and has seen a lot of different things. And, you know, I would say that his chance to, you know, take a break from that and go into media, working at Sportsnet and Hockey Night, that, you know, maybe opened his eyes to some different things and a different way to watch the game, maybe. But at the end of the day, it's still hockey and it's still, you know, what he knows and what he's seen and been through. So, you know, I think it's a fascinating pairing, to be honest. Those two guys working together, like I said, and I think he's a guy that is open to new ideas and is open to the conversation. And I think that's what I'd love to be a fly on the wall for, is that conversation that goes back and forth between the two.
Frank, the first night, I think this news broke, or the first time you guys were on TV, I remember you specifically mentioning Chris Pryor. Mm-hmm. Keep an eye out for this. This could happen. And as it turns out, that's why you're an insider. He ends up coming along to Pittsburgh. What will he add? How will he help Hextall as they kind of make this transition here in the next year or two in the draft and trying to kind of rebuild after, you know, these great players that they have here at the end of their career move on?
Well, I think he does a number of things. One is familiarity. He's a welcoming face for Ron Hextall. And when I called him in a tweet the other day, Hextall's right-hand man, I almost feel like I was underselling it in a way. He's more like his right arm. And if you watched how close those two were in Philly and how well they worked together, you know, it was zero shock at all. Like, I knew it was only a matter of time for those two to be working together again. I think they always wanted, you know, if one got an opportunity somewhere, that the idea was to bring the other along. And so the other part is, in addition to the familiar face, the other part that you're seeing is, or you will see, is the increased success and hit rate on draft picks. And I think, you know, that's the one thing that the Flyers really struggled with for a while. It wasn't hitting on draft picks. It was, they were always kind of in that same mode that, that the Penguins were in. Like, if you look back to their last, you know, number of years before Ron Hextall in the Paul Holmgren era, they were constantly trading picks, first round picks, to be competitive. And so at a certain point they smartened up, of course. And the other part is they started hitting on players further down in the draft. You know, you see an Oscar Lindblom, for instance, a fifth round pick. You see Nick Aubé-Kubel, a second round pick. A Mark Friedman, who of course the Penguins just grabbed on waivers, a third round pick. Those guys make a huge difference. And you go draft by draft and you see Ivan Provorov and Travis Konechny, both picks in the first round, nailed that. And you go down the list and you start to see some of these other players that are making big dents in the Flyers lineup. When you have limited assets like the Penguins do, and you're not planning on moving draft picks in order to be successful and be competitive in the future, you've got to hit. And so the idea will be to accumulate as many of those as they can, which I believe Ron Hextall will try and do. And the other part is to drill down on them. And that's what Chris Pryor does. He, you know, every draft board has its holes and its misses, but he did a lot better than most from those drafts.
All right. Obviously, what you're ramping up for, the trade deadline here, about another month to go. I'm not going to ask you right now who you're expecting to get moved and where they're getting moved, but how does COVID change this? You know, we just saw a couple weeks ago with the trade with Columbus and Winnipeg. It took Pierre-Luc Dubois like 2 weeks to play a game just because of having to quarantine. What are some of the factors here as we're going through this battle with this virus that may impact the way that we see the trade deadline this year?
You know, I don't know that it's going to have a huge impact necessarily on the, you know, the quarantine part of it. Like at the end of the day, if the quarantine was 2 months for Pierre-Luc Dubois going to Winnipeg, they would have done it because they believe they were getting a top-notch impact player that's going to, you know, be part of that team for the next 4 years, if not longer. That's just how long he's under team control. And so, you know, if you're talking about real impact players, I think teams are going to find a way to do whatever is necessary, move heaven and earth in order to bring them in. If they really are significantly increasing their either their playoff chances or more likely their Stanley Cup chances, then you're still going to see those types of moves happen. Now, I think where you're going to see a little bit of a drop off is in some of the fringe moves or the depth transactions. And that's, you know, you look at a Jake Virtanen trade that was supposed to have materialized over the weekend between Vancouver and Anaheim. I believe Danton Heinen was the other piece going or scheduled to go from Anaheim to Vancouver. And I think those two teams got cold feet because they're saying, well, with the 2 week quarantine and we're not, you know, how much of an impact are these players really going to have on our team? And I think at the end of the day, the decision was not much. Let's hold off. Yeah. And so I think that's a big, you know, example of why you could see, you know, some of those trades. You know, we're not going to see as many of those in the COVID era. But if you're talking real impact players and there just seems to be less of them on the market this year, I don't know if it's because of COVID or what, but it just seems to be a thin trade bait class as we posted our first trade bait board of the season on TSN.ca earlier today. And you know, it's going to be interesting to watch it all unfold over the next 6 weeks.
Do you think we might see deals happen earlier than they normally would leading up to the trade deadline, less like actually deadline day deals because of that quarantine period?
Maybe. But again, it's one of those things, you know, before you would get a player for 18 to 20 games at the deadline. So it's a compounded thing. It's not just the quarantine. It's also the shortened season. Whereas now you're looking at somewhere of a 10 to 12 game impact in the regular season plus playoffs. And if you're dealing with a quarantine, you're looking at maybe 6 games. So could it speed it up? It could. But like I said, you know, teams are going to try and do anything they can to get an impact player, regardless of whatever the time frame is, if a player like that is available.
Frank, you mentioned the impact that the quarantine could have on the trade deadline. What kind of impact does the quarantine have on, say, a TV guy who lives in Philadelphia but works for a network that's based in Canada?
Dave, it's been so bizarre. You know, I know you've traveled for a long time, and I know all of you have traveled a bit, but I haven't been on a plane, you know, in approaching one calendar year. March 8th was my last flight. I came home from the NHL's GM's meetings in Boca Raton, Florida, and I haven't gotten on a plane since. And it's been the strangest thing, you know, not traveling, but also not, I can't, like, it's hard for me to get excited about the idea of traveling, and not because of the virus. That's, of course, always in the back of your mind. It's just, when you go to the rink now, like I like to press the flesh. I like to talk to people. And it's the strangest thing, you know, not being able to be in the dressing room and to talk to people directly, relying on Zoom. And so it's hard to really work up an explanation as to why you should be. And so that's sort of been difficult for me to grapple with. But yeah, it's hard to not be, to know that in 6 weeks when we have Trade Center, and we'd have this sort of 10 or 12 hour marathon day of TV that I'm going to be sitting in my basement doing it, connected through our TV platform. It doesn't feel the same. And I think the whole season hasn't felt the same for a lot of reasons, not me work related, but just not having fans in the building. And I know the Penguins announced today that they're going to have some fans back finally, but it's made it a little bit harder. I don't know, to get as juiced up for the season, if I'm being honest. Do any of you guys feel the same?
It's certainly different.
Yeah, I agree.
Frank, we'll get you out of here on this one. One of the dominating stories of the last week in the NHL was with what happened with Artemi Panarin. And obviously the Penguins have a prominent Russian player as well. How weird is this story, and how unsettling is it to see a player, one of the league's top players, kind of going through this, and kind of the political overtones, which is something I don't think that we have seen since a lot of the kind of the wall fell, and when players first came over, maybe. But just what's it been like kind of in this story and seeing what's happening with Panarin and maybe the fallout with some of the other Russian players?
It's been definitely weird and definitely unsettling to think that a player is fearing for his safety and his family's safety when something like that pops up. And so that's, you feel for him. And I got to tell you, I was, when the story first broke and my bosses at TSN called and I was, trying to wrap my head around the whole thing and understand it, I don't remember being faced with a story exactly like that. And I've covered a lot of really, different ones. I don't even want to say strange, but the way that it sort of certainly seems like it falls into the political sphere. And then like you're trying to cut through and understand a world that I don't really know anything about. Like you guys, I've read about a lot of what's happening in Russia, and I stay up on current events, and I understand the distaste for Vladimir Putin. And the rest of it, I don't know enough about to really write a story on. And so you don't understand what's true and what isn't. Was this a coach, a former coach that's just spouting off? Does he actually have pressure on him from the government to make claims like that? You don't know. And all I know is that if a player is feeling that upset and scared by it, that it's real. And the fact that he one of the best players, one of the top 10 players in the game, needs to take a leave of absence from one of the NHL's marquee franchises. Well, that just goes to show you how powerful that pull is. And that's what's sort of been difficult to digest. And also just knowing that I don't know enough to really dive into it.
Yeah. Frank, it was a pleasure to have you. Frank Cervalli, TSN insider. I hope everyone reads his work. And he's obviously going to be really busy here in the next weeks as we get down, count down toward deadline. That's it today on the 66 to 87 podcast. I'm Tom Reed. And for Taylor Haas and Dave Molinari and Frank Cervalli, we'll talk to you next time.